Hello, I'm Darren Newman, and this is the Range of Reasonable Responses podcast. In this series, I've been looking at classic employment law cases of the past, seeing what they were really about and trying to make sense of what they mean for us today. In this episode, I'm looking at East Lindsey District Council against Daubney. This is a classic case about dismissal for long-term sickness absence, and it takes us all the way back to 1977. When this case was decided by the Employment Appeal Tribunal on the 20th of April, Jim Callaghan was our Prime Minister, leading a government with no majority, propped up by a deal with one of the smaller parties, the Liberals, in this case. Inflation was just over 17%, and in sport, Red Rum had won his third Grand National. This was also the first year in which the World Snooker Championship was televised and moved to the Sheffield Crucible, and it netted the champion John Spencer a prize of £6,000. Perhaps most importantly of all, the number one hit single in the UK was ABBA, Knowing Me, Knowing You, the biggest hit single of the year. Mr. Daubney was a surveyor and public health officer, and he'd been employed by Horncastle Rural District Council since 1959. In 1974, there was a local government reorganisation. The Rural District Council ceased to exist and Mr. Daubney was transferred across to East Lindsey District Council. All goes quite smoothly for the first year, but then Mr. Daubney unfortunately suffers a mild stroke. As a result of that, he's absent from work, and after about 2 months' absence, the personnel director, that's what they were called in those days, wrote to the district community physician. Reading the letter, it seems quite a period piece. Starts off, "Dear Dr. Haig, I wonder whether you would be good enough to let me have a report on the state of health of Mr. G.E. Daubney of Scotney Bargrove, Tattersall Road, Woodhall Spa." It goes on to describe his job and the sort of thing that involves. And then it says, "Perhaps you would be good enough to indicate whether you feel that Mr. Daubney's health is such that he should be retired on grounds of permanent ill health." The reply to that letter comes just under a month later, and it goes like this. "Thank you for your letter of 27th of June 1975 regarding the above-named employee. I asked Dr. O'Hagan of Horncastle to examine Mr. Daubney and have now received his report. Because of his remarks, I feel that Mr. Daubney is unfit to carry out the duties of his post and should be retired on the grounds of permanent ill health." It seems that those are the only details we get. The next thing we know, 5 days later, Mr. Daubney is given written notice of his dismissal. Now, the employer took that decision without any direct communication with Mr. Daubney. They didn't discuss the medical report with him. In fact, it appears that nobody in the district council actually saw a copy of the medical report itself. They were simply relying on the written conclusions sent to them by Dr. Haig. Now, Mr. Daubney claims unfair dismissal and the tribunal upholds his claim. And they do that basically on two grounds. First of all, they find that the council had not done enough to make inquiries about the medical position. And in particular, they should have got a detailed medical report as to Mr. Daubney's fitness for work. Secondly, they say that it was unfair to proceed to dismiss Mr. Daubney without talking to him first about the medical report that they'd received. The council appealed, and one of the things they were concerned about was the tribunal was essentially asking them, they thought, to second-guess the medical expert, and they said that surely they should be entitled to rely on the expert view given by their own doctor. The EAT was a little bit unsure about this. They said that it wasn't for employers to take the role of medical experts, but at the same time they had to make such inquiries as were reasonable about what the medical position was. Nevertheless, they did think that demanding a full medical report would be going too far for an employer. It was when dealing with the second issue, though, the question of consultation with Mr. Daubney, that the EAT sets out the classic case, the paragraph that gets quoted time and time again, even today. This is what the EAT says. "It comes to this. Unless there are wholly exceptional circumstances, before an employee is dismissed on the grounds of ill health, it is necessary that he should be consulted and the matter discussed with him, and that in one way or another, steps should be taken by the employer to discover the true medical position. We do not propose to lay down detailed principles to be applied in such cases, for what will be necessary in one case may not be appropriate in another. But if in every case employers take such steps as are sensible according to the circumstances, to consult the employee and to discuss the matter with him, and to inform themselves upon the true medical position, it will be found in practice that all that is necessary has been done. In this case, of course, there'd been absolutely no discussion with Mr. Daubeny whatsoever, and so the EAT was perfectly happy with the tribunal's second ground, at least, for finding an unfair dismissal, and the appeal was dismissed. Now, although this case is obviously still good law, it gets quoted over and over again, you can't help but being struck when you read it how far we've come over the years since this case was decided. Or to put it another way, to look at how much additional detail the law of unfair dismissal has accrued when it comes to dismissal for long-term absence. When you think about it, all the EAT was really saying the employer in this case had to do was have a bit of a chat with Mr. Daubeny to see if there was some way of getting him back to work within a reasonable time frame. It's difficult to imagine nowadays an employer getting away with such a sketchy investigation of the medical circumstances. We'd expect them to go much further in terms of getting a proper medical report, perhaps looking at doctor's notes, perhaps looking at a specifically commissioned report from Occupational Health. You'd expect the conclusions of that report to be communicated to the employee, and rather than just a chat, I think in most cases we'd expect the employer to try its best, at least, to organise a proper meeting with the employee, essentially a hearing. In fact, between 2004 and 2008, when we had the statutory dispute resolution procedures in place, and if you're too young to remember them, good for you, you would have actually been required to have a hearing for the employee in this case, otherwise it would have been an automatically unfair dismissal. Now that those procedures are long gone, there's no formal requirement to have a hearing as such, but I think the idea still persists that what we're looking for from an employer is much more than a casual conversation with an employee about a brief medical report prepared by a doctor. So modern cases will still use the phraseology of Daubeny. What we're looking for is the employer to take steps to ascertain the true medical position. That's very much a phrase you'll hear over and over again. But when we say that, I think we're expecting employers to go much further than East Lindsay District Council did. What we're looking for is not a medical opinion as to whether or not somebody should be dismissed. That's a managerial or a legal question, it's not a medical question. But what we are looking for is a prognosis. We want a prediction as to when the employee is going to return to work. Because this is the important thing about dismissing somebody for long-term absence. You're not punishing them for the length of time they've been off. You're simply taking the decision that they're not likely to return within a reasonable time frame. It's future absence that really counts, not previous absence. The biggest difference, though, is that you really can't think today about dismissal for long-term sickness absence without also taking into account disability discrimination. Because the fact is that any employee who's been off sick long enough to be vulnerable to dismissal is almost certainly going to be disabled within the meaning of the Equality Act. And that means that if they're dismissed, that will be unfavourable treatment because of something, their absence, that arises in consequence of their disability. That means that it comes within the definition of discrimination found in Section 15 of the Equality Act, and the employer, to avoid liability, will have to show that what they've done is a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. Now, in the past couple of years, for some reason, people have really latched on to Section 15 claims, and I've seen more and more of them coming through in the case law. But one thing that strikes me hasn't been satisfactorily resolved yet is the relationship between the unfair dismissal test, which is essentially range of reasonable responses, has the employer behaved reasonably, and the justification test in the Equality Act, whether what the employer's done is a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. I would have said that the discrimination test is a much stricter test than range of reasonable responses and general reasonableness. In other words, the employer might be complying with the established standards on unfair dismissal, but fail at the hurdle of discrimination. So what they did was reasonable, it was within the range of reasonable responses, but wasn't actually a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. Given the years of case law on both of those tests, I really don't see what the alternatives are. Having said that, it appears that the Court of Appeal doesn't agree with me. Not for the first time. The case we need to look at is O'Brien against Bolton St Catherine's Academy. A teacher was off sick for a year because of post-traumatic stress disorder following assault by a pupil. And at the end of the year, she was basically being considered for dismissal and was invited to a hearing. At the hearing, there was no particular evidence that she presented that she was likely to return to work, and so she was dismissed. When it came to the appeal hearing, however, she presented a fit note saying that, in fact, she was now fit to return to work. But the employer was sceptical. They thought that she was either not going to be able to return to work at all, or that she would be returning for a short period and then the sickness absence would start all over again. So they refused at the appeal hearing to take into account that fit note. Now, the tribunal held, not surprisingly, frankly, that that was an unfair dismissal. Because even if the employer was entitled to be sceptical about whether the fit note accurately reflected the position, a reasonable employer would at least have taken some time to look behind it, to get further medical information to find out whether, in fact, she was fit to return to work or not. And that needn't have taken more than a couple of weeks. A reasonable employer would have been able to take that extra time, bearing in mind how long she'd already been off. Having held it was an unfair dismissal, the tribunal also held that it was discrimination under Section 15 of the Equality Act. It wasn't a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim because they'd found that the employer had behaved unreasonably, and how can it be proportionate to behave unreasonably? One of the arguments on appeal was whether the tribunal had wrongly conflated the test of reasonableness under unfair dismissal and proportionality under Section 15 and assumed that if one test was failed, then the other test was failed as well. The Court of Appeal held that they hadn't fallen into that error, but Lord Justice Underhill went on to say, in effect, that it wouldn't have made that much difference. Here's what he says, in fact. It would be a pity if there were any real distinction in the context of dismissal for long-term sickness where the employee is disabled within the meaning of the 2010 Act. The law is complicated enough without parties and tribunals having routinely to judge the dismissal of such an employee by one standard for the purpose of an unfair dismissal claim and by a different standard for the purpose of discrimination law. Fortunately, I see no reason why that should be so. Now, I can see that it's perfectly straightforward if the employer has failed the reasonableness test when it comes to unfair dismissal to say that that almost certainly means that the employer has failed the proportionate means of achieving a legitimate means test under discrimination law, because that's a higher test. A more interesting case would be one where the employer is held to have acted reasonably by the standards of unfair dismissal law, and the question then arises as to whether they might have acted unreasonably or disproportionately by the standard of discrimination law. And I'm sorry to do this to you, but we do have a case on that. The case is the EAT decision of City of York Council against Grosset. Now, the facts of this are a little bit odd. Basically, a teacher gets dismissed for showing an inappropriate film to vulnerable teenagers near the end of term. He gets dismissed for that, and the tribunal basically finds that the dismissal is fair. But by the time of the tribunal hearing, the employee has evidence which the tribunal accepts that the lack of judgment or the lapse in judgment that led to the teacher showing this particular film actually had its roots in a disability, namely cystic fibrosis. Now, the link between someone having cystic fibrosis and making the inappropriate decision to show what was a horror film to vulnerable teenagers isn't one that leaps out at you. If you're interested in exactly how it's established, read the tribunal decision. For our purposes, let's just accept that the link is there. The tribunal found that the employer knew about the disability, so it's covered by Section 15, but didn't know about the link between the disability and the lapse in judgment. Had they known about that link, the tribunal says, it would have been a straightforward matter to make allowances for that in deciding what the appropriate penalty was. And on that basis, they find that the employer has failed in establishing the objective test, that what it did was a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. So, get to the EAT, the EAT accepts that just because this was a fair dismissal, that doesn't mean that it was also justified in terms of Section 15 of the Equality Act. It was open to the tribunal to find a fair dismissal, but also to find unlawful discrimination. I don't know whether that case is destined for the Court of Appeal. I hope it is. I think there's a lot to unpick there. But my point is that the central question remains unresolved. What is the relationship between unfair dismissal law and disability discrimination law? That's a question we really need the Court of Appeal, possibly the Supreme Court, to have a good look at. In the meantime, can you imagine what the personnel director of East Lindsey District Council would make of this debate? Anyway, look, I've gone on far too long. That's all from this episode. If you like this sort of thing, then do subscribe on iTunes. Check out the written blog, A Range of Reasonable Responses. And of course, you can also find me on Twitter. I'm at Daz Newman. Join me again soon for some more classic cases from the Employment Law Archives. And in the meantime, thanks for listening. Knowing me, knowing you, there is nothing we can